Today marks the third anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, we're marking the Pulse anniversary during this Pride Month, and we're taking your calls too. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, author Chris Gabbard, plus how you can do your part to reduce pollution in the St. John's River this summer. All of that ahead. But first this morning, today marks the third anniversary of the single worst attack on gay Americans in our nation's history. 49 people were killed and another 53 were injured at the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. The massacre took place during Pride Month, the time when LGBT communities worldwide celebrate their community. In the wake of the shooting, an unprecedented number of blood donors emerged to help the Pulse survivors, so many, in fact, that a documentary was made about it.
Blood, the life force. No life can survive without it. We take it for granted until it's taken away from us.
So I was on the floor and I was holding my stomach and I look and I see blood all over. And at the same time I'm on the floor, I'm thinking about how do I get out from here?
The impact made my arm explode and it wrecked, like it shattered my whole arm. My nerve system was gone.
It felt like a lake. It was like a lake of blood just flowing out of me.
Either I was gonna bleed to death or he was gonna come again and shoot me.
Every shot I was getting, I can feel my body jumping because of the power of the gun, I believe.
That film is called Lifeline. Now, 3 years later, there's also a movement to make the Pulse nightclub site a national memorial. And at the same time, an effort is underway to pass statewide protections for the LGBT community. We decided to begin the hour looking at all of this as we mark the Pulse anniversary and discuss everything that's happened since as we welcome in studio Michael Myers. He's president of Jacksonville's LGBT Community Fund. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And Susan Forbes, senior vice president with One Blood. She's on the line from Orlando. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And of course, it is Pride Month this June, and Friday is World Blood Donor Day. So lots of anniversaries and observances to talk about this morning as we mark the third anniversary of the Pulse tragedy. And we want your calls and reflections as we get into all of the issues affecting the state's LGBTQ citizens. What are your thoughts and comments? It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open as well. Michael Myers, let's begin with you. 3 years ago today, the Pulse mass shooting took place, the worst attack on LGBT people in American history. And, you know, all of us who were working that day here at WJCT well remember the reports coming in from Orlando, and, you know, everything that's happened since in Florida has been a steady movement toward more workplace and social protections for people, including here in Jacksonville. And so as we look back at Pulse, what are your immediate thoughts?
Well, continuing great sadness. I mean, what a sad day for America. I think is all that you can really say. I think that if you look at the position of LGBTQ people more generally, that if you step back, we have to say that the amount of progress that's been made over the past years has been truly remarkable. I mean, gay people can now marry. In Florida, gay people can adopt children. We have an openly gay candidate running for president of the United States, and he's polling well. So there,
Pete Buttigieg,
yes.
Yeah.
So there is, in many ways, a lot of good things to celebrate. But at the same time, the current administration is doing a lot of negative things for the LGBTQ community. So. They're doing them directly, as in rolling back protections that were progress that was made in the Obama administration. And then they're also opening up a whole new front in the ongoing dialogue in our society about it with the religious freedom regulations and then positions taken by the administration.
So that's the new front in this battle. Tell us a little bit more about what you're observing there.
Well, basically what it is give in our society, we constantly have lines to draw between what the rights are people in pursuing their religion and what the rights are of people just to be citizens. And so the religious freedom battle, the one that people have heard the most about so far, relates to wedding cakes. And where bakers have said, because I object to gay marriage, I don't want to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple. But it's now moving to other areas where basically the government is proposing that if healthcare providers can decline to provide healthcare because they object to who the person is. So if a dentist doesn't want to deal with a trans person, the dentist can say, I don't want to do it. And there are proposals and some litigation in this area now that would allow that dentist to say no. And exactly where, how all that sorts out, you know, will unfold over the coming years. But I think that the religious freedom movement is going to be the big new area of fight around LGBTQ rights.
It's 549-2937 as we discuss the ongoing push for full LGBT equality in America 3 years after the Pulse shooting. So much going on with this, you know, even all over the world, there's been a flap over U.S. embassies flying the Pride flag this month. Some have defied the White House and flown it, even though they have asked that it not be flown. Here in Florida, there is a continuing push in the state legislature to pass the Florida Competitive Workforce Act. It would add LGBT people to the list of groups statewide who can't be legally discriminated against. And, you know, Susan, on the line from Orlando, there's a push to make the Pulse nightclub site a national memorial. As we talk about all of this, let's also talk about how this coming Friday is World Blood Donor Day. You were on the scene during Pulse and the aftermath, dealing with how many blood donors emerged following that tragedy. Tell me a little bit about what happened that week that you experienced and some of the lessons that can be learned.
Well, it's a day that obviously we will never forget. It was a blood donation really became, you know, a huge part of the story because tens of thousands of people emerged instantly before our eyes to donate blood, and they helped replenish the blood supply in record time. And as the media and around the globe was focusing on these long lines, I kept stressing to them that, you know, to remember that blood is needed in advance of it ever being needed, and that the people who donated just a few days before the Pulse tragedy that were helping save these survivors' lives, and encouraging, you know, the community to understand the importance of a ready blood supply around our country and really around the world, because when we see these types of tragedies emerging, it is every time the blood supply in those areas is playing a role in saving these victims' lives. So the outpouring of love and support that we saw from the community of these donors coming out, we collected over 28,000 units of blood in 7 days, which is really unheard of to collect that much blood in that amount of time. And, you know, people would think, oh, well, you had enough blood, you were good for a while. But what had transpired is that by, you know, seven days we collect that amount of blood, but by the following week, 85% of that blood had already been distributed to our hospital partners. So it shows you how quickly, as it's donated, it's tested, it's processed, it's out the door, because there is never a day when blood is not needed.
Right. And so on Friday, which is World Blood Donor Day, there will be a big push to encourage people to donate blood, because as you said, it's needed all the time. the nature of that event was so extreme, so bloody, so horrific. The need was so great. And that speaks to our violent society. Organizations like yours are absolutely critical because as we mark the incredible loss of life at Pulse, it's also important to note that first responders and blood donors and your organization and many others saved a lot of lives too.
Absolutely. And that's why we often you'll hear me refer to blood donors as the first responders, because they do their part days before the blood is ever needed. And as a result, they are saving people's lives. And you won't always, you don't know who that blood is going to, but you can know as a blood donor that you are helping save somebody's life. You're helping keep families together. You're saving people. And you know, over 441 units of blood were transfused at Orlando Regional Medical Center that night to save those Pulse survivors. That's an unprecedented amount of blood to be used in 24 hours. We've made 8 trips over there to deliver more blood to them because they were going through it so quickly. It was unreal, you know. And at the same time, we're having all these donors show up, you know, before we were early hours of the morning lining up waiting to donate blood. So it really is something that you don't want to take the blood supply for granted, because in an instant, something like this can happen and the blood supply has to be ready. And it's not something that you want. Don't wait for the tragedy, you know, to become a blood donor. And when we did the documentary that it's now on Amazon Prime, it's literally helping save additional lives because it's bringing awareness on the need to make blood donation a habit and do it each and every time you are eligible. And by doing so, you are doing a tremendous service to your community and helping save people's lives. And you know, it's not just needed during a tragedy. It's cancer patients, premature babies, sickle cell patients, you know, transplant patients. The list goes on and on of the amount of people who need blood on a daily basis. And the only place it can come from is another human being.
Yeah. Let me ask you as a follow-up, Susan. This is an uncomfortable question, I guess, but all those blood donations saved a lot of lives in Orlando. Certainly. At the same time, there are restrictions on gay men in this country donating blood. The men in that nightclub that needed the blood so badly to live, many of them would not be accepted as a blood donor still in this country. Can you explain why?
Well, One Blood, like all blood centers across the country, is required to follow all rules and guidelines handed down by the Food and Drug Administration. So the policy that you are referring to is known as the Men Who Have Sex with Men policy, known as MSM policy. And it's one of many policies that are out there that we have to follow. We don't make the rules, but we have to follow them. And in 2015, the FDA lifted its lifetime ban on men who have sex with men and moved to a one-year MSM deferral policy, which was a decision that One Blood supported and has implemented. And at the same time, One Blood is one of 4 large blood centers who have received a multi-center research agreement to identify and further characterize risk factors in blood donors who are infected with HIV and hepatitis. And this research is permitting an effective and very focused assessment of risk for all potential donors, regardless of sexual orientation. So we are actively participating in that research. And, you know, hopefully when all the research is in, it's a 5-year study, but there's about a little over 1 more year left of that study. And we may be able to see additional changes made to that policy going forward. But One Blood has to follow everything that the Food and Drug Administration says we need to do. So we don't make those rules, but those are the ones we must follow.
Right. The blood banks are following the rules set down by the government, Michael. A listener's tweeting the show saying it's not One Blood's fault, but this policy is discriminatory. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the starting point is that it is very important that we have a pure blood supply, that we don't want to be transmitting diseases through blood. I think the question, at least that I have, is whether, given the technology and how much more we know about HIV today, whether the policy still makes sense. And so the government moved some steps going from lifetime to the 1 year deferral. And the question, you know, is whether the science would support going beyond that.
Okay. And lots of different threads to this story as we mark the third anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shootings and the ongoing movement for full equality for LGBT Americans in Florida and the nation. What are your thoughts, questions? It's 549-2937. Andy is on Beach Boulevard. Andy, good morning.
Good morning. You do an excellent show, as always, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Thanks.
Thousands of people donate blood regularly, and then all of a sudden, after giving blood 10 or 20 times, they just suddenly are told, nope, we can't take your blood anymore, and you ask why. And it turns out, well, you tested positive, but then we checked that it was a false positive, and so don't worry about it. We won't take your blood. Telling somebody that you can't take their blood because of a false positive just seems like out of the third world. It just seems idiot. It just seems stupid. And if it, don't tell me it's a federal policy, because if it's a federal policy, the main people the feds listen to would be the Blood Alliance and what the policy ought to be. The Blood Alliance ought to fight that we should not reject blood from people just because they have a false positive on some test.
All right. Thanks for that. Susan Forbes, you know, the overwhelming message you want to get out is the need for blood donations generally. But what about that question?
Well, if a false positive occurs, there are steps to that we have to follow, again, per the FDA, for people to be readmitted back in. And many times people are, if it's a false positive. So there are steps to be taken to be readmitted, and it happens all the time. So if the caller is not getting those answers, I can be happy to help him get in touch with the right people.
And let me ask you, Michael, getting back to just the horrible event itself, it was an extremely traumatic event for the city of Orlando, but it was also traumatic for LGBT Americans all over the country. This was the single worst attack in American history on this group of people. And it's a pretty deep wound.
It is a very deep wound. And I guess I don't really know much more to say about it than that. The part to me that is the saddest is that variations of this kind of wound go on around our country all the time. And it's extremely troubling for all of us, I think.
And what do you think about the push among some Florida lawmakers, Central Florida legislators, to make the Pulse site a national memorial?
I think it would be a wonderful thing. I think that we should have a memorial, and that is the logical place to do it.
At the same time, here in Jacksonville, after a long fight, the city updated its human rights ordinance.
Right.
You can no longer officially discriminate in this city against LGBT people in jobs, public places, public accommodations is the terminology that's used, and in housing. Now, at the statewide level, there have been several efforts over the years to pass the Florida Competitive Workforce Act, which would essentially do the same thing, but at the statewide level.
Correct.
It keeps failing, although it keeps coming back again and again. And at the same time, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, right after he was sworn in, he issued an executive order saying that his administration would prohibit discrimination in employment in a number of categories, except this one, sexual orientation and gender identity. And so what about the whole picture across Florida as 3 years after Pulse, this kind of statewide legal protection is still missing?
Right. Well, for better or worse, the progress that is getting made is much more in local communities and in cities around the state. And so far, people have not been able to mount a successful effort to do it on a statewide basis. I think Jacksonville is an interesting place to talk about. So the HRO was done in 2017, and a huge positive thing. I mean, that's a very good thing. And the interesting things to me is, at least to my knowledge, there has not been a single complaint brought under the law under the ordinance. And mm-hmm. so you might say, well, then that must mean nothing is going on. The last time I was on your show, I talked about the survey that the LGBT Fund conducted in Jacksonville of the LGBTQ community. And one of the two of the big takeaways out of that survey were that of the respondents of the survey, 3 out of 4 felt that they had experienced everyday discrimination in the past 12 months. And half of the respondents said they did not think Jacksonville was a welcoming place for the LGBT community.
Do you agree with that?
I do and I don't. What do you mean by that? Well, what I would say is I think a lot of people don't feel that they don't feel like they're welcomed and celebrated in Jacksonville.
Have you experienced discrimination yourself? Can you share some incidents?
I've been pretty fortunate and not really had a lot of bad things happen to me. So mm-hmm. I would say, you know, like I'm married, I have mm-hmm. two kids, and happily in the places that we've interacted, we've been okay. But a lot of people don't feel that way in Jacksonville. And I mean, they don't feel that way. So what I would say is, for Jacksonville as a community, it's just really not right. And then for Jacksonville as a business center, I don't think that's the reputation that we want to have.
Right, and certainly the corporate sector led the way on this. They pulled the city officials along behind them. Major corporations in Jacksonville for years before the HRO was updated these policies. At the same time, after marriage equality passed nationwide, we saw backlash in Jacksonville. Courthouse weddings went away.
Right.
You can no longer get married in a little chapel at the Duval County Courthouse because folks there don't want to conduct same-sex marriages.
Right. So if you listen to the debate before the HRO was adopted, I mean, I think what a number of the opponents of it said was that the sky was going to fall if we did this. And we did it, and the sky hasn't fallen. So I think that is all pretty positive. But I guess what I wanted to say was on the fund side, with the LGBT fund, what we have been doing is studying the survey results. And what we are going to be focusing on is working to build greater connectedness within the LGBT community and helping Jacksonville to welcome and celebrate its LGBTQ population. We want to try to make Jacksonville a more inclusive place, and that's really going to be a big focus for us over the next few years.
What are some steps you're going to be taking?
Well, we are still kind of going through the specifics, but they are going to be like Pride occurs in Jacksonville in early October. So we're planning some events around that, both for the LGBTQ community and for integrating mm-hmm. the LGBT community into the broader population. Fernandina Beach just celebrated its first Pride event last weekend. They are also in the process of doing an HRO. So we've been involved in that as well.
And Susan Forbes, still on the line with us from Orlando. Of course, you're with us to talk about the need for blood donors. But at the same time, down there in Central Florida, what's the mood like as this momentum grows to make the Pulse site a national memorial?
Well, you know, it's at the Pulse today and even yesterday, and there's a lot of different events taking place this week. And it's, you know, it's somber. It's but at the same time, it's hopeful, you know, that we can see this as a national memorial. And, you know, today we're down there with our blood drives and, you know, people are coming together once again and remembering. And it's still a somber moment. And I don't think it will ever not be that on this day when you look back on what happened. Living here and having experienced that, it was unfathomable that that would happen in downtown Orlando. And we had our own team member who was impacted and passed away in that tragedy, who was there that night. Somebody who helps save lives every day at the blood center ends up, you know, passing away there. Today we remember him. And, you know, it will never not be a difficult day for us here in Orlando.
Let's go to Mitch in Ortega. Hi, Mitch. You're on the air. Good morning. Hi, Mitch. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. I just, wanted to recognize certainly the tragedy of the Pulse massacre in Orlando. But I also wanted to bring up the situation in Jacksonville with RHRO. And my understanding regarding the HRO is that it really has no teeth, that it applies to an extremely limited base of employers, 50 employees or more, I believe. It has numerous exemptions for religious organizations and persons who claim to be part of religious organizations. And then the worst that can happen is go to arbitration. And the penalties are extremely minimal. So could you comment on that as to what the real situation is with RHRO?
Sure. Michael Myers, what about that?
Sure. I think that there is some validity to what you say, but I also think that the passing the HRO was an incredibly important thing. It sets a moral tone for the community. And in the way of having to do any legislation, you have to make compromises with it. I think the compromises, the biggest one that was made was that the religious exemption is a bit broader, but the other exclusions from it are the same as the, at least my understanding is they are exactly the same as in the other non-discrimination elements based on race, sex, et cetera, in the Jacksonville HRO.
And I'm getting tweets asking me to point out that there have been some complaints made under the HRO to the Human Rights Commission, which would handle those complaints.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Okay, then I stand corrected.
Okay.
If that's the case, I had not heard that.
But there is a redress for discrimination, it now goes to the Human Rights Commission,
correct,
which will handle it, just so people understand how it works. And let's go to Dominique on the West Side. Hi, Dominique. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was just reflecting on the past 3 years and where I was 3 years ago. I was actually on my way down to the nightclub when that was happening.
Could have been there, you mean, that night?
Yes.
Wow.
And I was due to go down with a bunch of my friends, but I guess in a way, thankfully, my friend had gotten sick, and we ended up staying at her house in Orange City, which is near Orlando, and it was so horrible to feel what I was feeling inside when I heard about what was happening or what had happened, because we could have been there, and, you know, God knows what that could have been like for not just me, myself, and my friends, but others that were possibly on the way to the nightclub and to experience that. And thankfully, nothing happened out of that.
Yeah. Thankfully you, just through whatever flukes occurred that day, you weren't there. At the same time, what are your thoughts about where Florida stands today in terms of LGBT equality and also the effort to make that site a national memorial?
I am 110% on board with making the Pulse nightclub a national memorial. I'm not a Florida native. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we've always had extensive human rights up in that area. I do think, and I've been here 8 years, and I think that as Florida as a whole, I think we're on the right path to LGBT rights and human rights, and everything. So I think, Florida is on the right path with human rights and LGBT rights for all.
Thanks for that, Dominique. And Susan Forbes, before we let you go, could you let everyone know one last time how they can donate blood, especially this Friday, which is World Blood Donor Day?
Well, you can go to oneblood.org, and all of our locations are listed there. You just type in your zip code, and it'll show you the nearest Big Red Bus blood drive near you or a donor center near you. So that's up there at oneblood.org. And I encourage you to donate each time that you are eligible, because you are helping ensure a ready blood supply for our community.
Thanks for that, Susan. Susan Forbes, Senior Vice President with One Blood, on the phone from Orlando, and Michael Myers, President of the LGBT Community Fund here in Jacksonville. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Above and Beyond Tree Service has been serving the Jacksonville area for over 15 years. Locally owned and operated, they offer tree trimming and removal, storm cleanup, and property maintenance for residential and commercial properties. More info at aboveandbeyondtree.com.
High Tide Burrito Company, local since 2009, caters to hungry employees and bosses with fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food for lunch or parties. No more same old. Menu and ordering at hightideburrito.com.
Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit WJCT.org/events to explore what's coming your way. Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon, the best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Local author and professor Chris Gabbard is a well-regarded scholar of the Enlightenment. He believed in the Socratic philosophy that the unexamined life is not worth living. But all of his beliefs were questioned after he had his son, and he and his wife went through harrowing times after August was born, and then had the experience of raising a child with severe cognitive and physical disabilities. This story is captured in Chris's new book, A Life Beyond Reason. He joins us now in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm a great fan of the show, and I've always wanted to meet you.
Oh, well, it's good to meet you. And you're getting raves for this book, beyond that of most local authors, I'll just say that, making a national splash with A Life Beyond Reason. And so tell me a little bit more about August and what happened when he was born.
Okay, well, the book talks about our experience of both his birth and raising him, and unfortunately about his passing away. He was born in 1999 in San Francisco at a prestigious teaching hospital. And for various reasons, things went wrong during the delivery. And he suffered what's called HIE, or a hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. And, that's basically what it amounts to is he had a lack of blood and oxygen in his system when he was being delivered, and he suffered extreme brain damage. So the result was that he was a spastic quadriplegic, which means he had cerebral palsy in all four limbs. He was nonverbal. He was cortically blind, meaning he couldn't see much. And he had profound cognitive impairment. So he was quite a kid to take care of. But he was also, but over the years, he turned out to be a jolly little fellow, the most cheerful person you could imagine, just a little munchkin, delightful to be with. And so it was a great pleasure also taking care of him. In taking care of him, though, we had to do a great deal. We had to be at both his hands and feet and eyes. We had to hand feed him. He couldn't move for the most part. And so there was a lot of issues. Anyway, I wound up taking a job at the University of North Florida in 2001, and we moved out here. And we encountered a great problem, which is something I'd like to bring to people's attention, is that we were put on a waiting list to receive vital services that was over a decade long. And we were not the only family. There was probably, at this time, about probably 20,000 families in Florida with children similar to August who are waiting to receive vital services. The Agency for Persons with Disabilities will put people on a wait list because the taxing and funding priorities of the state legislature and the government, state government, are such that there's just not support for these kids. So this is something that I'm really surprised that there's only one journalist in Florida that I'm aware of that's raising this issue on a continual basis, and that's Scott Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Scott Maxwell writes for the Orlando Sentinel, and he has written several times on this issue. But as far as I know, he's the only journalist that has repeatedly brought this to attention.
Well, we'll have to work on that ourselves, won't we?
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, the experience of raising August caused you to question some of your most deeply held beliefs. How so?
Well, I always believed that the unexamined life was not worth living. That is what Socrates said. And after my son was born and after a few years of processing what had happened, I began to realize that August would never be able to examine his life. And did that mean that his life was not worth living? And I could see from what happiness he had. He was quite a cheerful fellow, as I said before. The fact that he was so upbeat and so, I don't know, enthusiastic about life, even though he couldn't see and he couldn't move and he couldn't think very well, it forced me to reexamine that assumption that I'd carried since I was a young man. And I really came to the conclusion, and this is part of what the book talks about, it's not the unexamined life that's not worth living, it's the life without love. And August gave a lot of love, and he received a lot of love. And I think that is something that has to be taken into account when thinking about people. What August was is what's called a non-autonomous being, someone who could not work on his own behalf. He had little agency. And yet we have to think about these people. We often think of them as vegetables, but vegetable is way too reductive a term to adequately embrace all the ideas that a person like August brings into life. He changed my life tremendously, my wife's life, my daughter's life, and so it set me on a whole new path.
In that sense, his life was a gift to all of you.
Well, we certainly gained knowledge from our encounter with him. So, yes, and one thing I say at the very end of the book, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but if I had known what his life would have been like before we had him, but I didn't know the love that he would be able to bring out in all of us, I probably would have wanted to abort him. But in retrospect, knowing what I know now, I would never have gone down that road. I would go through it willingly again.
So this isn't necessarily a pro-life book, but it sounds as though it has caused you to think deeply about all the issues around abortion. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, abortion doesn't come into the book at all. It's just basically, I personally am pro-life. I misspoke. I'm personally pro-choice, but I do believe that a child like August benefited our life greatly, and I'm glad that he was in our life.
There are so many themes and issues and tangents in this book that so many parents, I think, can relate to, whether you're the parent of a special needs child or not, but particularly if you are the parent of a special needs child. What an incredible challenge that can be for parents, how exhausting it can be, how expensive it can be, how it changes parents in profound ways. And it sounds as though that's what happened in your household.
Well, I don't want to mitigate how taxing and difficult the process was. It was a very difficult life. I wouldn't wish it on anyone in that regard. But in the case of August, he gave us so much back that it made the work worth it. Mm-hmm. But I can understand where, considering there's so little public support, public help for families like this, why it is such a difficult choice for people to make if they know that they're carrying a child that would have severe disabilities. That's why I stay on the pro-choice side, because it's too complicated an issue to legislate. I don't see how any law can be passed that would criminalize abortion, that would take into account all the other circumstances. Life is messy. And so But again, the book is not really an intervention on the discussion of abortion. I really didn't want to go there. I'd rather stay on the positive aspects that August brought into my life and raising a disabled child can bring, but also raise public awareness about the lack of public support for families like this.
What would you like to see change in Florida in particular?
All the kids off the waiting list. There's 20,000 of them. When Rick Scott was running for the Senate, no, this is before, when he was running for governor for re-election. Prior to the election, he took about 800 families off the waiting list. That still left over 19,000 families on the waiting list waiting for vital services. That was just a cheap political ploy as far as I was concerned, just to make it look like he was doing something when in actual fact the great bulk of families are still on there. I really wrote the book also to represent those families. Many people don't have an ability to bring these issues to the fore. I was very lucky to be able to write a book that would be published by a national publishing company to talk about these issues. There are hundreds of thousands, if not billions, of families like mine out there who don't have that opportunity to talk about these issues. So I feel that it's my duty to come and represent them.
You wrote this after August passed away.
Yes.
And how long did he live?
He was alive for 14 years. He died in 2013. It's a story behind that. 2010, I wrote a piece for the Chronicle of Higher Education about August, about how how we felt that just because his life was not, he was not able to examine his life, it was still worth living. And an agent contacted me right after that and asked if I wanted to write a book. And I said, well, I'd love to, but I don't have time because taking care of him takes up so much of my, I had no spare time to write a book. The day after he died, I emailed her and I said, I'm ready to write that book now. And so for four and a half years after that, I spent writing the book.
Cathartic for you?
It allowed me to put things into an order, into a shape that I wouldn't have an opportunity to do otherwise. Part of the problem with writing a memoir is that you also have to put it into an order and a shape. And so as you shape and order something, you also begin to kind of lose contact with it because it takes on a life of its own. That's part of the problem of writing. I'm a writing teacher at UNF as well as an English literature professor.
Well, let me just say that it is my great pleasure to shine a little bit of a light on an underwriter on this program, San Marco Books and More, because you, Chris Gabbard, author and memoirist and professor, will be doing a book signing on July 11th and a discussion about your book, A Life Beyond Reason, at San Marco Books and More. This is an opportunity for everyone to come out and meet you and talk about all the aspects of August's life and what you want to share with the public.
Great. That'll be at 6:30.
Yeah.
Okay.
And particularly, I think parents with special needs will be excited to meet you and share their stories.
I'd love to have them come out.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. And kudos on the success of your book.
Thank you very much.
It's being very well reviewed by Kirkus Reviews and others. And so for UNF, too, a feather in their cap to have a professor of your caliber here and an author of renown. So author and professor Chris Gabbard, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this book is out now. It's called A Life Beyond Reason, A Father's Memoir. You can meet Chris July 11th at San Marco Books and More. And in a moment, how you can do your part to reduce those algae blooms in the river, we'll explain next.
Above and Beyond Tree Service has been serving the Jacksonville area for over 15 years. Locally owned and operated, they offer tree trimming and removal, storm cleanup, and property maintenance for residential and commercial properties. More info at aboveandbeyondtree.com.
High Tide Burrito Company, local since 2009, caters to hungry employees and bosses with fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food for lunch or parties. No more same old. Menu and ordering at hightideburrito.com.
San Francisco is changing. New construction on every corner. Lots and lots of money. What don't you see?
What I don't see is black people that much. I don't see, diverse groups of friends even anymore.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the last black man in San Francisco. Next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. On the next Fresh Air...
Oh, that looks beautiful, Samuel. It has a stark beauty all its own.
As the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing approaches, Charles Fishman talks about how much of the Apollo program was improvised, from hand-wired computers to spacesuits designed by Playtex. His new book is One Giant Leap. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Many Catholics and Southern Baptists are demanding change after a series of sex and abuse scandals. Leaders of these two major denominations are meeting this week in Birmingham and in Baltimore. What lessons might each denomination learn from the other about how to reform? Facing up to failure for the sake of the faithful. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, those algae blooms are once again polluting the St. John's River this summer. But home and business owners can make smart choices that reduce algae in the water, and that includes your landscaping. Jason Duffney is a co-owner of Earthworks in Jacksonville. He is here now in today's Going Green. Hey, Jason. Good to see you.
You too, Melissa.
Okay, so you're a co-owner of Earthworks, great place. You oversee all the landscaping and the pond building departments. And so when people come to you, when they maybe want to set up a water feature, do some landscaping, you help them do it responsibly, which is becoming more and more important, right?
Yep.
How do you do that?
Well, we do it many ways. So there are people that want to go as green as possible. And we try to encourage, number one thing is the lawn is the most difficult part. That is the most difficult part about being as green as possible. So if they want to go full native and get rid of everything, we can help them. If you want that fully awesome looking, beat the Joneses type green yard, we help there as well. Our big thing is try to supplement with as many organics as possible so you can use less synthetics.
And that you're talking about fertilizers and products to keep the landscaping in the yard looking nice.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, there's so many things that I know you don't have time to talk about it today, but there's so many things like on the minute side of even just creating a rain garden that will capture water. Because one of the biggest problems in the St. John's is the amount of water runoff we have. So it's not just having to put so many fertilizers down, it's that it's escaping the yards. And so if you can kind of capture that, and I love what Atlantic Beach is doing where they're making people actually capture it in their yard now. They've made some rule changes. It makes my life very difficult, but it's good for the environment. It's good for flooding, stuff like that.
Sure.
But yeah, the biggest thing we do on our end is this command treatment. And anybody can come in, you can do it yourself. Actually, it's very easy to do, but we do it for a lot of our customers now. And it's an organic treatment. It has this biodiverse life living in it. And it actually helps us to where we do not have to use as many chemicals later in the year.
Now, you're a leader in this space. Just over last weekend, you at Earthworks led a bus tour around town on a tour of private ponds and gardens to show how native plants not only look great, but they're good for the environment and they reduce pollution.
Yep.
So you want to encourage people as they're making choices to try to use native plants wherever they can. Why is that important?
Well, it's as important as, and it's the same thing. So our what you're talking about is our pond and garden weekend we just had, and we did a tour bus. The winner from the St. John's Riverkeepers contest they had was actually on the bus too, so it was fun. But the most important part is trying to reduplicate the ecosystem, nature, in your backyard. And it's encouraging wildlife back in, and it's also trying to keep it to where you can do as many natives as possible so they don't need as much water. That's number one. Number two is most of the natives are actually part of bringing nature back in, and they help. Every little bit actually helps. Having insects in your yard is a good thing. Mm-hmm. It actually is a very good thing, and it's hard to explain, but.
Right. It helps things along. Now, we've had a pretty dry spell. What advice do you have for people who are worried about their lawn or their plants dying, particularly with water restrictions?
It's a tough one, and that's why I go back to the lawn. The lawn is the toughest thing. If you were installing mostly all hedges, trees, things like that, they need water for the first year. After that, they kind of almost can take care of themselves. They can handle those droughts. But the lawn is the tough one, and you just got to keep a close eye on it. It's really just the water. I mean, that's the bad part about it is you have to put so much water on it.
And if you can, reduce how much lawn you have, right?
You can reduce the amount of water you need, yeah.
And then you use less water.
Yep.
And so you do all of this at Earthworks. By the way, I did not know this because I've driven by your business a million times and also patronized it. It started with two guys who gave up their corporate jobs to mow lawns.
Correct.
And it grew from there?
Yep.
What a success story.
Yep. So Doug and Mark are the two that actually started the company. They worked in businesses across from each other. And they said, let's get out of this corporate life and go back to doing what we like to do. Because they grew up just like I did in the garden industry in some way, shape, or form. And they wanted to go back what they enjoyed as a kids.
Well, kudos on all the success. Yep. And if you want to build a river-friendly yard, a private pond, a water feature, a garden, Jason is your man. So Jason Duffney, one of the co-owners of Earthworks, he's our spotlight today on Going Green. So always good to spotlight locally owned businesses as well. Kudos, Jason. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always value your feedback. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We do see every email, even though we can't always quickly individually respond to them. So keep those emails coming. On tomorrow's show, how to house Florida's ex-offenders. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.